Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
And here we are. This is Interpreter Radio. It is Sunday, October 31st. It's Halloween. You know, that great holy evening before All Saints Day that's been changed into trick-or-treat, that sort of thing. But we're here in studio, Terry Hutchison and me. We are co-hosting. I'm Martin Tanner. And we have what I think is going to be a fun program in store for you. We're going to talk about some of our favorite books. And then during our second hour, we're going to talk about Declarations 1 and 2. Of course, the end of polygamy, and then the revelation about priesthood for all worthy men. And before we do that, we should do a little bit.
Articles of faith, too, Mark.
And articles of faith. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we should also mention before we do that that this is the Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. And the Interpreter Foundation, many of you listening will know this, but we should mention it for those who are new to this program, is a wonderful organization. You can find it on the internet at interpreterfoundation.org. It supports the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. Its purpose is to provide those who are interested with all kinds of tools, from this radio show, other radio shows, some fabulous articles, research, scholarship in many different directions on all kinds of topics that support the Book of Mormon and its mission and its teachings, explaining things to those who are non-specialists in a way that's easily understandable or more easily understandable. And one of the most important things that the Interpreter Foundation does is respond to criticisms, whether from critics with an axe to grind or from those who just don't know. And either way, if you have a question or concern about the church that's come to mind, or you know someone else who does, you might want to go to interpreterfoundation.org and take a look at that little, you know, Sherlock Holmes looking glass there, and find in the search box the answer to some question. There's a number of wonderful publications that the Interpreter Foundation has been involved with over the years. We also, of course, as you may have guessed because of our discussion about second hour and Come Follow Me, we do a series each week on the Come Follow Me lesson. And we are always several weeks ahead of the current curriculum, so that if you so choose, you can take a look at what the upcoming lessons are all about. So there you have it. That's our background. And for our first hour here, Terry, it's a pleasure to be here with you. You know, Terry, many of you will know Terry some, but he's a St. George guy. Terry, tell people a little bit about your background and your radio stuff.
This is a little different audience for us.
It is. Sorry,
just spreading COVID around the world.
Yeah, just getting over COVID.
That's right, exactly. Not really, but I live in St. George, and for the last 27 years, I've had a daily book review program on KVXU Radio down there. Starts about 5 minutes to 7 in the morning. In the afternoons, we've run different things, and right now I've got one that's 1 minute. But the book show is on all different topics, not just, I mean, we do novels, we do kids' books. Usually every Thursday I do a religious book. We do a lot of Latter-day Saint books. We do a lot of non-Latter-day Saint books. It just depends. Whatever suits my fancy, whatever is interested. I particularly like books on history, both American history, world history, church history, you know, whatever it is. So I view myself as being widely read. Not quite as deep maybe as some, And I also, for the last 3 years, have been a co-host on the second Sunday of this program. And my co-hosts are John Gee and Kevin Christensen, both of whom have written much more extensively on Latter-day Saint topics than I am. John, in particular, is extremely knowledgeable about technical material. So I can get this through the technical material, but I don't really have a lot of languages. There's a story I like to tell. In my third year of law school at BYU, I had the biblical law course from Jack Welch. And Jack has recently retired the last few years, and I know that he's working on a lot of projects. He runs Book of Mormon Central, Pearl of Great Price Central, Doctrine and Covenant Central. I presume we're going to see some Old Testament and some New Testament Central as well eventually. And Jack was one of the original founders of Barms. And most of the original Farms people came to Interpreter Foundation. And Farms kind of came about when I was just at BYU as an undergraduate and as a graduate student. And I have followed it almost my entire life. And so I have a really great home here at Interpreter Radio as well as the Interpreter Journal. Haven't quite cracked that thing yet, but I really haven't submitted. I've been in Meridian Magazine a few times, and probably will have something coming up in this next year, a little regular basis with them. I'm not as super scholarly as most of those who submit to Interpreter, but I really enjoy trying to take those things that are a little deeper or a little more technical, help give them to a general. But, Martin, it's been great to be with you. We've done this a couple of times, and a couple of times you come in when John's here. And I noticed that, sometimes Dan Peterson comes in with you on the fifth Sunday, but I think Dan's in California, and next, he's getting ready for that tour to Egypt they're taking next month. And so, anyway, I'm just happy to be here, and we'll be here on a more regular basis on the fifth Sundays. But this is a topic that... And I talked about on my program Thursday. I told people at St. George, hey, listen here, go online, listening to podcasts. So I want to welcome new listeners to this program. And a lot of them are curious, well, what are my favorite books? So every year about the middle of December, I do my books of the year on my regular program. So I'll do 3 fiction books, I'll do 3 nonfiction books, then I'll do a young adult book, I'll do an audio book, and I'll do a religious book. In the last couple of years, I've done a LDS book of the year and a non-LDS book of the year. So, we have all kinds of people. Then I've had the chance on my program when I've co-hosted the hour-long calling down at St. George, and I did it a little bit in July, and I may get another chance to interview. So I've had Dan Bogle on my program. I've had Will Bagley on my program twice. First time went really well. The second time, not quite so well for him, for some reasons that, you can come on, you can, Dan and I had some initial bruises, but got through it. I don't have a problem with somebody if they're academically honest and if they're honest about who they are and what they represent. So when Dan did his biography of Joseph Smith, I had him on. I had some hard questions for him about the biography itself, the positions he took, and everything else. But where we really had a problem is when he was trying to market the book as being somebody really from the LDS tradition as a returned missionary, not admitting, okay, yeah, I went on a mission, but
I did a 180 since then.
Yeah, I've done a 180. So, hey, as long as you come in and you're okay, and then we're not going to have a problem. If you're going to be academically dishonest, you know how it is. When you have somebody on the air, you don't want to make it an attack on people. You don't want to have guests come in and attack them. But on the other hand, there is some kind of honesty that they have to have. And so That's so I've got a lot of that. I've had Richard Bushman on 3 times, Terrell Givens on 4 times. We've had Terrell Givens on Interpreter with myself and John, Kevin. I do like to interview authors. So it's just been a great experience over the years. And so I have a lot of books, and I've when you mentioned, you know, a month or so ago, hey, Terry, let's do this. I thought this will be great because you know, I've been reading your contributions to farms and everything. I know that you're widely read. You participate with Dan Hale every week. So I think between the two of us, we come up with some things. But my books of the year are not really always the best. It's like, look, I'm not a critic from the New York Times or somewhere else. I'm not looking for literary value. I'm looking for something that's going to educate me, something that's going to entertain me, something that's going to keep me turning the pages. And so my list today about the 20 books are books that really had an influence on me. I mean, I like them. I continually go back to them. But I don't always, you know, I wouldn't say they're the all-time best religious books, because that really is a little bit subjective.
So these are books that have had an influence on you.
Yes.
And ones that you want to talk about tonight, but
sure.
Maybe in 3 weeks your list might be different.
No, not quite. It might be a little different, but the vast majority of them are books that really are influential, and they led me. And so one of the things that we can talk about, we do, is it's not just the content of the book, because the people pick up the books, they can look at books and reviews or whatever. It's how did you come on, and how did it influence you? So, you know, there's some books on my list that completely changed my life over the last dozen years. In a way, in a very positive, but in a way that kind of was unexpected. And so it's those kind of books that really kind of get attention, and they start when you're young. You know? So, for example, I would lead off with the
Let's jump into it. Yeah, go for it.
When I was a teenager, by Bruce McConkie. Now, my grandfather, Ellis Christensen in Bridgefield, had a first edition on the shelf. And I'd always heard about the first edition a little bit, didn't know much about it. My parents gave me the second edition, fourth edition, and I took that one. So when I was studying, that was a good place to start. Remember, mission president Alan Brown said, well, you know, Elder McConkie is a good place to start, but don't think it's the end. So, you know, that always struck me. It is always still a place where I start. I'm good friends with one of Bruce's sons down in St. George. He'd ride his bike over to my office some sunny mornings, beautiful, and, you know, blue sky down where we are, and we always have that. We don't really have the view up here. He'd come in about 8:30 in the morning. He'd go, Brother Terry. We'd have some great conversation about, let's talk about King David. And so, you know, there's just a real influence from Bruce McConkie, you know, the foundations of my study. And so that's one of the most influential. And right before my mission, I also read The Premortal Messiah, which was the first of his Messiah series. And that one, for me, is actually the best of all the books that he's written, because it opened up the Old Testament to me in a way that nobody ever had before. So it was like, all of a sudden, we're talking about Jesus. We're talking about the prophecies of Jesus as they appear in the Old Testament. And it was something that filled a gap that I had when I'd read the Old Testament earlier in seminary. Just, you know, okay, what's the purpose of this? But when you really focus on the same things in the Old Testament that you do on the covenants and the temple, looking for the Messiah, you start looking for those things and finding that is just a revelation to me. It really got me started on that. So I've never fallen on when it comes to studying the scriptures in. So those are a couple of examples of LDS books from our mission. So what have you got?
Very cool. Well, I'd like to start off with a book that had a huge influence on me. It was written by John T. Noonan Jr., who was one of dozens and dozens and dozens of justices on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And for people who follow the Ninth Circuit, they kind of think, oh, liberal crazy off the charts, lean a little bit left, or at least from an unusual circuit. And they don't often think of how many hundreds of justices there are in the Ninth Circuit. That's a huge area that they cover in a lot of cases that they sort through. But the title of the book is The Believer and the Powers That Are. And the subtitle is Cases, History, and Other Data Bearing on the Relation of Religion and Government. And when I saw that, I thought, this sounds really interesting. And it's a fairly beefy book. And it was published back in 1987. Honestly, I'm not sure if it's in print, but I know copies are available. This was not a New York Times bestseller, as you might imagine. But the thing that was fascinating for me in reading that was that I understood that there was this idea of separation of church and state out there. And I also understood that from my readings, Congress was always open and closed by prayer from a paid chaplain. And I thought, how does that work? You know, and I thought, well, you know, and there are 10 commandments in front of the courthouse, but
yeah. Gee,
there's this separation of church. And so how does all this work out? And Noonan, in his book, just does this masterful job of going through how the idea of religion and government have changed over time from the founding until now. And the change has been quite dramatic. There were early Supreme Court decisions that were opined or that were written by the Chief Justice, John Jay, that said this is a Christian nation and the precepts that we use to deliberate, you know, are Christian in their origins. And no Supreme Court justice would ever say that today. And it went through and talked about the different discussions about the First Amendment and where they all came from and the purpose behind the First Amendment. It's just a fascinating book that gives you this history of religion in connection with government and how things changed over time and how the Danbury Baptist letter was kind of misused by the Supreme Court to get to the decision that they had that really, you know, pulled the idea of prayer and other religious activities out of school to the extent it's been.
I'm interested to see how they're going to treat some of that this next term, because there's a case up there right now that's going to go back. And I'm going to be surprised if it doesn't, especially concerning the current. We're not going to promote a state religion, but on the other hand, that doesn't mean we're going to completely ban state religion. And we saw a little bit of that in the last term. I think it was the foster care decision of the city of Philadelphia, where they said, listen, you're going to let a group do something. Chance to do this or do that, you have to also
Though
they may not, the Catholic agency doesn't want to adopt to gay parents or something like that. It's an area of the law that's still in determination. It's going back what I believe is the correct direction.
Yeah, hopefully the pendulum will swing back.
Well, you know,
it
is kind of interesting. One of the things I didn't mention earlier, that one of the reasons I don't hour-long calling in St. George, where I was the primary guest host for years, is I'm official there. I'm on Washington County School, and so we deal with these issues. We deal with issues of prayer in school, dealing with some right now, some of the civil rights cases that are coming out with regard to gender, things like that. So, you know, last year was an election year, so. They told me they won. So I last minute. He said, well, yeah, you're up for election. We better not. So yeah.
We'll have to give equal time to all those other people.
Yeah. Well, you know, and actually they don't have to. But they seem to. So, anyway, you know, it is interesting, though, because the books that we cross, okay, really affect us. I mean, as I was mentioning, I had Jack Welch's Biblical Law class, and I did a paper that I really enjoyed, but obviously I was crammed with all my finals, and so, you know, it was just a typical student. Remember the grade I got back? Pretty average. Maybe a little below average, but pretty average. And he did make a kind comment. He said, this is a good topic. And then he said, learn a couple of languages like German or French. And spend about 10 years on your reading and studying. Maybe it'll be publishable someday. We're not quite there yet, but it was, you know, it did set me on a path that led there. You know, another experience I had was up in Owen Sound, Ontario, which is a little town up on the Great Lakes, okay, kind of a bay, about an hour and a half's drive from Toronto. We were really isolated. At the time, it was a town of about 20,000, and there was myself and another missionary. You know how those rural areas get sometimes, and the next missionaries are about an hour away drive. And we were walking downtown, and in one of the local bookshops, there was a picture of a paperback book with Salt Lake Temple on it. I'd never heard of the book. I'd never heard of the authors. I thought, wow, this is interesting. So I picked it up. The Changing World of Mormonism by Gerald and Sandra Tanner. And for those who are younger, maybe you don't know, but the Tanners were classic authors who attacked the church for years and years and years. They had a ministry up here in Salt Lake where they would just publish things, and all of the traditional attacks on the Book of Mormon, on Joseph Smith, everything, they were more traditional about.
Right.
They followed in. In fact, some of the early works of Farms, as I recall, especially the Farms Review of books on the Book of Mormon, some of the things, Martin, that you published in way back, you know, when I first started following, were responses to some of these more traditional Protestant evangelical attacks on the church.
And Gerald has passed away, Sandra still has the Utah Lighthouse Ministry, and you can still go in there and get all the stuff.
See, and I've never set foot in the place, which is a little odd because I've been just about everywhere else. But, you know, she was in the documentary, the Hoffman documentary.
Yes. Yep.
And yet, in spite of their desire for it to be true, her husband, Gerald, never believed that the Salamander letter was
real. Right. No, that was a big dichotomy between them, and also between them and other critics. Although I stridently disagreed with Gerald and Sandra Tanner, there were many, many others who were just harsh for the sake of being harsh, and I think even though they were a bit jaded in their approach, they were a little more honest than some.
They were sincere believers in trying to get people converted to what they thought.
Yes.
As opposed to just attacking it for the sake of tearing it down.
Right. One of my problems with them, and I don't want to turn this into a, you know, an anti-Gerald and Sandra Tanner thing, but that led me to believe that they were maybe a little less than completely honest was when I went through preparing for a 3-hour debate that I had with them one time on the radio in the late 1980s. I went through Mormonism, Shadow or Reality, which was kind of their magnum opus, their great big huge thing. And I looked up some of their sources. I didn't have time to look up all of them, but there'd be an ellipses in there. And the word that was removed was not, or something like that, which completely reversed the meaning of some of the stuff in there. And I thought, you know, this, if you're just pulling words out to try to make the opposite meaning appear, this is this is not always completely
well. That's the point
accurate.
I was going to bring up is I'm a young missionary and I'm fresh out of Utah camping. And I've never really come across a lot of this stuff, and so it was a fascinating look for me, and it was eye opening. I mean, it was the first time I'd ever heard of there being more than one version of vision.
Sure.
And I remember for a little time, I didn't have any doubts per se, but it was like, really? I mean, it was just like, how does this fit into the worldview? And eventually I got it figured out. I figured it out fairly quickly, but that was a thing that really impacted me. Yeah. And going forward, and it always has. And so every time I've come across anything like that, I've always done the same thing, which is you look at it, you let it soak in, you don't jump to conclusions early, you just figure it out. And once that was over, it was really, you know, never much of a problem for me going forward.
A lot of it's the way it's presented. I remember going through Gerald and Sandra Tanner's stuff about the different versions of the first vision, which you just brought up, and this just demonstrates. And if you think about it, I wonder what would happen if these two evangelical Christians would apply that same methodology to the Synoptic Gospels.
Well, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Bauckham.
Exactly. That's the point.
Has a second edition that's come out. That's not on my list. It's a little bit technical. I've tried to keep my list fairly non-technical, but, it was just one of those things that that was formative, not that it's anything I would recommend. But I think all of us at some point have to go through that process where some of what we believe or we understand is challenged, and then we can put it in a framework of faith. So another one that came shortly after that was James Charlesworth. I remember being in the BYU bookstore and seeing the Old Testament Pseudepigrapha Volume 1, and then later Volume 2, a couple years later. And I was just like, I've never seen anything like this. I don't know what it is. And especially the first volume, which has First Enoch, Second Enoch, Third Enoch, then it has the Martyrdom and Ascension of Isaiah, and it just goes on from there. Steve Robinson from BYU was one of the contributors. I remember in the introduction thanked the Religious Studies Center from BYU as being a sponsor of this project. So, Brigham Young professors and scholars did have an influence on it. And so it was the type of thing that really started me on, a better understanding of the Old Testament through some of these extra canonical materials, so to speak. So that was another one that opened it up. And then shortly after that, of course, we jump back in, and the next real formative book for me was the Collected Works of Humility. That first one, Old Testament and Related Studies, came out. I remember in 1983, and I've talked about this on our other programs with John and Kevin, I had a class from you. I remember back in 1983 thinking, he's pretty old. He's going to retire one of these days. I should take a class from him. So we took the Pearl of Great Price. And I remember the class was just out into the hallway. And I had a special letter from the athletic department that let me, because I was trying to walk on sports, and that it let me sign up for any class. So he just looked at it and said, I'm going to sign this. Now, don't worry about it. These people will not be here after a week. And sure enough, within a week, it was just, the thing was almost empty. It was, and then I remembered the Pearl of Great Price class. He said, I always start with Abraham. Everybody expects me to start with Abraham. So this time, we're going to talk about the Joseph Smith history. And we're going to talk about the Joseph Smith Matthew. We spent 6 weeks on the Joseph Smith Matthew. And I remember within a week, I look back at my notes and I just think, why are we talking about the Babylonian pre-existence? So it was just, it was an eye-opener. But then, about 6 months later, we got Enoch the Prophet. And I had gathered as a missionary whenever I could. You know, you always had this closet full of old ensigns. And so I'd gathered those and put them together to try and collect the ones on the Book of Enoch, which really intrigued me. I really liked the story of Enoch and the Pearl of Great Price, but I wanted to know more about him. So the fact that there was this series of articles in Ensign, which we were allowed to read as missionaries, it was in the handbook. So I tried to put that all together and collected it to a book. You know, obviously it took, what, 20, 30 years? At least 20 years, a little more than 20, to get all 19 volumes out. And so that, you know, that's cheating a little bit because, you know, there's something in nearly every one of them. I mean, there's a couple in the Prophetic Book of Mormon, which is volume 8. Everybody likes Approaching Zion, which is number 9. You know, I like some in number 12. I like ones in Abraham later. Got John's new edition of the Message of the Joseph Smith Papyri that he helped with. And then you have the last one. So there's always something fairly unique there to look at. So that's another group.
Strange Thing in the Land, The Return of the Book of Enoch.
Yes. Yeah. From, I think it was 75 to 77. And they did a serial for it. You would no more see that current church magazine, Fly to the Moon. But they did that kind of thing all the time. And in fact, I didn't know that the Apocalypse of Abraham, which is, you know, a pseudepigraphal work about Abraham, but it talks a lot about his father worshiping idols and things like that, was originally published in English in the Improvement Era back in the 1890s.
I had no idea.
Now, the official English translation is by somebody named Box, and I think it came out in the early 1900s. But several years before, there was a kind of an informal translation of it published by one of the church magazines.
Interesting.
So, what have you got next?
What have I got next? One of the most impactful lectures that I ever heard was I had a couple of people, a colleague and a secretary and a few other people who said, I've heard that there's this really cool lecture, Martin, you ought to go with us. And so after work, I don't even remember what day of the week it was, we went to Skyline High School, and it was obviously in the afternoon, school was out, over for the day, and it was this guy named George Ritchie, who was an MD, and George G. Ritchie, was talking about this experience he had, where he had doubled pneumonia as a 20-year-old soldier, and died and left his physical body, and he started talking about all these different things that just kind of fit in with church doctrine about, you know, what Jesus looked like and what the purpose of life was and about addictions and things. And I was fascinated by it. This would have been in, I think, 1988. And I got to meet Ritchie. And he had written a book called Return from Tomorrow, which is still in print, even though he passed away in 07.
There's a lot of those near-death experience books. That was really a big thing, even in the Farms Reviews back in the early 90s.
George Ritchie was the first of the first of the first, which is why I bring him up. Raymond Moody published his book in 75, a few years before Ritchie's book, but Raymond Moody, who was an MD, PhD, and also a professor, knew Ritchie and said, "Yeah, George, you're a psychiatrist. How do you explain all these patients of mine who are having these weird things where they claim to have, you know, is this hallucinations or what?" And Ritchie says to Moody, "Well, I've had one." And that made Moody sit up and take notice, because here's this lucid guy who was president of the Richmond Academy of Psychiatrists or whatever the exact title was, and the gist of it, he held him in high regard. And so if this guy said, I've really had an experience like this, Moody took notice, and then he wrote his book. And I got to know Richie pretty well, and I don't mention this often, but I'm on the board of directors for the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and have been involved in, I probably...
Oh, that's a mouthful, so no wonder you don't mention it very often.
I am, yeah. But I've interviewed personally over 600 people who have had near-death experiences, and it's been a fascinating thing for me to hear things that back up gospel principles. Not all of the claims do, but I found that if you sort down, if you drill down, those are assumptions that people make about their experiences, and that if you really can sort out the facts, they really do. You know, what one person's reincarnation might be our preexistence, for example. So if you hear somebody, you know, use that, for, you know, use the reincarnation phrase, you know, don't be alarmed. They're just using a different word to describe what we believe. But the point is, that had a great impact on me, that there might be another way other than pure faith to sort of triangulate and support through an entirely different field the beliefs of the church. And I've come to find and believe that's really true. So George Ritchie, personally, his book about his own experience, Return from Tomorrow, and then Moody, who's still around, who's very eccentric and a fascinating guy, but who I would consider a friend, have had an interesting impact on my life. Back to you.
Well, you know, that kind of brings me to my time, you know, wrapping up in law school. I remember in 1985, Leonard Arrington came out with American Moses, his biography of Brigham, and that totally changed the way that I viewed Brigham Young. It showed me in particular that Brigham was very dedicated to Joseph, that he was all about doing whatever it was that Joseph said, and that he wanted to follow things, and pretty much he said that what he taught and what he did were things that Joseph had left him or instructed him, and we don't really have any record of it. Well, and it caused me to think about this a little bit, and I've seen some other articles where that speculation is the case, and it's like, okay, say Brigham has this thing that a lot of people have problems with or they disagree with. Would they have the same feelings if it came from Joseph? You know, those are the kinds of things that are there. But that really was the first time that I had engaged with Brigham Young, and so it was a very important thing for me. It showed me how the way that historians or authors treat their subjects is so important. We know that from Vaughn Brody and Joseph Smith. I mean, the fact that it took us 40 years, well, actually maybe 60 years, to get from No Man Knows My History to Rough Stone Rolling is just amazing to me. I don't know why anybody in the church put up with that. I mean, you know, either nobody could engage, nobody could get the material, nobody dared. I don't know what it was, but that for me was something that, you know, really opened my eyes, was when Leonard Arrington did that. And the story behind that he talks about in the book. He said he went in with the names of a few other people to President Kimball, to who he proposed the project to, and said, hey, these brothers or whoever will do a good job. And President Kimball just said, no, I want you to do it. And so he did. And what a phenomenal job. I know there's a critically acclaimed one from John Turner of Harvard, who's now working on his own Joseph Smith one. And Turner is not LDS. But he's not anti, so he's more realistic. But I still go back to Arrington every time. I've been recommending it to my listeners for years. So that was a big one for me right there.
I know there are some people who are critical of Leonard Arrington. My grandfather was the head of the Institute at the University of Idaho and thought very, very highly of Leonard Arrington. And my grandfather was one of the ones who was sent to University of Chicago as part of this six who went and got their master's degrees there. And she had a great interest in scholarship, and he just thought Leonard Arrington was absolutely wonderful, and I always shared that belief.
Uh-huh. So, you know, then I graduated. I went out into the world. I was in the military, stationed in Kansas, so pretty far from the Wasatch Front. And every time I got back, I'd go to BYU or I'd get to the stores, see what new volumes of Nibley came out, and was trying to follow those during the 4 years I was there. And I think we got all the way up to number 10 before I got out of the Army to St. George. And, when I was in the Army, though, I started reviewing books professionally. And the way that came about, and people ask me about it on my program at St. George all the time, is there was a newspaper there at Kansas. We were stationed at Fort Riley. Every Sunday, they would put out a book page, and if your review was published on the page, they'd pay you $10. And more important to me, especially, you got to keep the book. So,
which is pretty cool.
And one of those that I got was called the Revised English Bible, and it was a different translation than the King James, and it was a different translation than the New Revised Standard Version, which is pretty much the scholarly standard. And I really loved the language of that book. And I just remember, especially there was a place, and it really showed me the value of different translations, or emphasized that. Jeremiah, there's a passage in Jeremiah where, in the King James, it talks about the burden of the Lord. But yet this one put it in a language, in just regular language, and it's nothing fancy, but it says, how can anything the Lord asks you to do burden? Never again say, oh, here's the burden of the word of the Lord. No, it's not a burden. It's a blessing. And just the way that was translated in such a positive way was just a reinforcement for me of the value of translations, and showing, you know, there's different ways to look at this. In my office, I have a statue of Michelangelo's Moses that was actually given to me by Stan. And my wife loves it because he's got horns on his head.
The one with the horns.
Yep. And I love it because of the beauty and the art, and I love Moses. In fact, I'm working on some long-term projects involved. But the horns. What's up with the horns? Well, at the time of Michelangelo, the scripture was translated that when Moses came down off of the mountain, he had horns on his head. It was, his face was shining, but they translated it and had horns on his head. And so, once again, the fallacies of men. But that was one of the things that got me started. And then I also, about the same time, read a book called A Little Thin Book, put out by Signature, of all things, back when they were not just kind of one note trying to do history in a certain way, but they had a more broad spectrum, called Women's Rights in Old Testament Times. And I remember reading that and for the first time seeing, okay, it's this law and this inheritance law that causes Ruth to act the way she does, that causes Rachel to act the way she does, that causes some of these women to do the things in the Old Testament that you look at it, if you don't understand, and you say, why are they doing that? And once again, it was another way of looking at the laws and helping me understand that understanding the background and context requires me to go outside the scriptures. But once I do, I get a much more clear picture of the people involved and what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so that was a huge impact on me. And I'd recommend that book to anybody. It's very accessible. And I had a lady in my ward in St. George say, you know, after I had taught a gospel doctrine class, I wish I could talk about the Old Testament the way you do. And I'm just thinking, well, it just takes a little time, but you can. But that's one of the things that you can do. It's a beautiful, simple little book. I don't know if it's in print or available electronically, but it certainly was important to me.
Very cool. Next one that I have on my list was The Hebrew Goddess by Columbia professor Raphael Patai. And the reason that I like that...
Oh, yeah,
that,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
This was published back in 1990. And I had occasion to talk with University of Utah professor who had written a book about the Jewish messiahs. It was a comprehensive list of all the Jewish men who claimed to be the Messiah. And Jesus was, of course, just one on his list. And we had talked back and forth, and he said, you know, you ought to get in touch with Professor Patai at Columbia. He would make a great guest on your radio show. You'd be interested in what he has to say because you're LDS. You guys believe in this Mother in Heaven stuff. So I thought, oh, okay. And so I got in touch with Patai, and he was excited. And we had this great long discussion. I had him on a few times on the radio. And the gist of his book, which is still in print and gone through several expanded editions, talks about the idea that, well, you know, maybe not in mainstream Judaism, but amongst the people and as kind of a background part of early Jewish theology. And by the way, Professor William Deaver would share the same point of view on this. This is not just a Patai thing.
Yeah, does God have a wife?
Yes, does God have a wife would be would
that's
be
one,
great
the
example.
Title of one of his books.
Yeah.
And he's just done one on a biography, autobiography. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have not seen the autobiography.
I think I have it in my bag in the car.
I like William Deaver. He's a great guy. And so Patai's book talks about the Jewish belief that God had a wife, that Yahweh had a consort. And I'm not going to get into all the distinctions between Yahweh and Elohim and who had the wife and who didn't, because I don't think that was much more clear to the early Jews than it is to some Latter-day Saints in some circles. But the point is that this idea of a heavenly mother was there in much of Jewish history and probably went away relatively
recently. Well, it was
recently
in the Babylonians, too, because one of the things that Nibley talked about in our class about Matthew was a Babylonian preexistence with a war in heaven where the mother god was on the side of the Satan character, the father god was on the side of the son, and then the mother god and
so
the
it
Satan
sounds like a typical family.
Out. Yeah,
I'm kidding.
Well, I'll let you say that. Yeah. You're a braver man than
no,
I'm
just... Bad joke, anyway.
Well, the Raphael Patai is kind of interesting because he was one of the contributors to the Nibley Festschrift, which is also one of my important. It's just the broad range of scholarship and topics, both from Latter-day Saint scholars as well as non-Latter-day Saint scholars in honor of Nibley, just was a fascinating thing. And then, you know, a while later, it kind of led to something from one of my co-hosts, Kevin Christensen. He did one of the Farms Occasional Papers, and it was a summary of the scholarship of Margaret Barker. And I remember reading that, and Bill Hamblin wrote a piece in introduction. It was either him or Dan Peterson, I can't remember. But they talked about how they were reading one of her books, and they kept saying, is this woman LDS? No. Yes. No. Yes. No. And
the,
so
the great that, angel, everybody great should angel. Read the great
well,
angel.
Yeah. Actually, that's not one of my favorites. So we have Paradigms Regained, Kevin Christensen. For those of you who haven't read it, it's somewhere online and you can find it. And Kevin told us a couple of weeks ago on our program that he has started an update. So he said he's about 30,000 words into the update. So I'm excited about that. But I don't know what else it's going to say, but my that leads me to my next one, which was Margaret Barker. My favorite is The Risen Lord. And even though the idea of the resurrection as being not really a physical resurrection, it's a little fuzzy and it's not as clear, the way that she deals with her arguments and citations in the footnotes is much more detailed and thorough than in any of her other works, including The Great High Priest. She likes summary footnotes. She doesn't like a heavy, detailed footnote, and nobody likes more meaty footnotes than me. So, you know, that's one of the reasons it's my favorite. But hand in hand with that, of course, is The Great High Priest, because the articles on Melchizedek, the issues of atonement, the issue of Jesus as the Great High Priest, all of those from a non-LDS perspective, but from the perspective of Old Testament, once again, getting back clear back to Bruce McConkie, the premortal Messiah, where you see the temple, where you see everything. I mean, the thing about Margaret Barker for me is that she raises the question that you just addressed with the mother goddess. In other words, the common people. Why did so many people, this is the question that Margaret raises for me that answered a question I have. Why did all the common people know and recognize Jesus? It wasn't just the miracles. It was the doctrines that had carried over from when they lost the temple in the first place. Yeah. And that's the whole theme of Margaret's writings for the most part. So she has this thing called temple theology that she's built on. And every one of her books builds on the other. I mean, you know, the one that you mentioned, which, you know, I mean, I've got the Gate of Heaven, and then we have...
Oh, the Great Angel.
The Great Angel. Right, right. The Great Angel. Then you have the Risen Lord. Well, actually, there's one in between, the Temple and New Testament or something.
Something like that. Margaret, yeah, one of the things that I really like about Margaret Barker is that she's a scholar, but she's also a genuine true believer.
Yes.
And
yes.
There are so many people who are scholars in the religious arena at leading universities who, if you really drill down, they're agnostic. And that's,
you know,
not her.
That used to be the case, but it's not so much now. Because when I talked to Stan about his father and his work on the mortal Messiah, I asked him, I said, why is he still referring back to Farrar and the people that Talmadge relied on? That was 100 years ago. He says, well, my dad says that anything now is godless. And that was true in the 80s and 70s when Elder McConkie was writing his Mortal Messiah books. I don't think that's the case as much now. You have believers. Now,
there are some. But if I put together a list of...
Well,
Bart Ehrman and his colleagues at North Carolina Chapel.
I don't count them as scholars. I frankly never read them.
Well, Bart Ehrman's probably the preeminent New Testament scholar. Anyway.
Richard Bauckham from St. Andrews, N.T. Tom Wright, those guys that are up there, and a lot of others, Crispin Fletcher Lewis, and it just seems that more and more Andrei Orlov, more and more of them are believers. I mean, they don't believe the same way that we do.
Well, the pendulum may have swung, but I like Margaret Barker because she is
Margaret
a believer.
Margaret is a believer for sure.
Yeah.
And certainly that changed the way that I studied the Old Testament. You know, and there's some others. I'd say the next big influence for me besides Rough Stone Rolling, Jeff Shaw, and his In God's Image and Likeness. I reviewed that book for... on my program, I said, this is a book that I wish I'd written. In fact, I even interviewed Jeff on my program about that book, and then I reviewed the second one. But when it comes to non-Latter-day Saints, the next real important book for me was one by Scott Hahn. He is a Catholic scholar. It came out in about 2009. It's part of the Anchor Yale Bible Reference Library,
okay.
And it's called Kinship by Covenant. And it is a deep dive into the idea of covenants all the way through the Old and New Testament. And in a sense, he ties it all in. But I lent it to my friend Stan. Just said, you know, Terry, this guy is as close as you can get without Latter-day Revelation. And that book, which has about 150 pages of notes and another 60 pages of bibliography, opened up a whole world of biblical scholarship to me that that I have been pursuing for the last dozen years. So it's just one of those things that I would encourage people to keep looking at.
You are listening to K-Talk Media, KBJA, AM 1540.
We'll be back. This is Interpreter
Sandy,
Radio.
Salt Lake, and the entire Wasatch Front. Live, local.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
We're back. This is Interpreter Radio. Terry Hutchison in studio. I'm Martin Tanner. Together we're co-hosting tonight on this fifth Sunday. We are here as hosts for the Interpreter Foundation, which is a wonderful organization that supports the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. Take a look at their website at interpreterfoundation.org for Come Follow Me discussions, for great articles on a wide variety of topics, and podcasts of this and many other shows
history. The foundation does some great things. The Witnesses movie that came out this past year that's now available on DVD and Blu-ray in Deseret Book, and a documentary coming out. Interpreter was one of the producers of that. They raised the money and obviously spent the money on a quality project. It was terrific. Terrific movie.
It is terrific. If you haven't seen it, go get the DVD.
Any donations
it is
that you make.
Fabulous.
Any donations you make, by the way, will be tax deductible. It's a 501c3. And you can know that nobody in Interpreter is getting paid. Not even, and not especially, Dan Peterson, since that seems to be the greatest claim. But I would also point out that there's a few of the office personnel and people who do some of the technical things that require money. They get a little bit of money. But,
the
Interpreter Foundation finances are on the website. We've got our quarterly reports. But one of the other great things they do, if you subscribe to it, they'll send you a weekly article. In fact, more than one a week. It'll just come to your email. You can read it. You can not read it. You can ignore it. Whatever you want to do, don't ignore it. But, you know, you can do those things. Now, we also have another sponsor, LDSAgents.com. So that's a group of Latter-day Saint real estate agents. There's about 3,000 of them. They've got a website. And if you're looking for a place to live, you can go to that website. They'll answer a lot of your questions, and you can be sure that whoever's helping you, whether it's trying to sell your house, which is not too hard in this market today, or whether you're trying to find an appropriate house, which is hugely difficult, you can know that the person helping you, the real estate agent, has some of your same values. They share your values. And also, they're professional, so they'll know the area you're trying to move. They'll know where the best housing is, where the best schools are, some of the youth sports, as well as maybe some of the other things involving the church itself that you may want help with. So, once again, we want to thank LDSAgents.com for sponsoring our program. Check out their website if you have the need. And they've been around for more than 20 years helping people with those kind of problems.
This program, this hour of this program, is on the Articles of Faith, the Official Declaration 1 and the Official Declaration 2. And these are enormously important in the history of the church. I thought maybe, Terry, we ought to start with the Official Declarations, because I think superficially those are fairly well known, but some of the details are fascinating and might help people understand why they occurred. And as you mentioned during our last hour, context is everything. If you know context, really understand things, and context will help people with the Official Declarations 1 and 2, the Manifesto, and then the priesthood to all worthy males. I guess I could start us off a little bit with some background for Official Declaration 1, or if you have some history, feel free to jump in.
I'll chip in as we go, but go ahead.
Okay. I've got a few notes here, because the Official Declaration 1 is something that people understand as sort of the end of polygamy. But it was also controversial then and now because there are people who say, well, wait a minute, if God's in charge, then why did this doctrine end as a result of governmental interference? That's the gist of the claim. And the short answer to that can be one of two ways. One is that by necessity, God gives not just good people, but bad people, and also people who don't understand things, free agency and free will, and we all have to work with that. Unless God's going to change
that,
things around.
That, the term that they prefer to use is moral agency. The latest rendition of the handbooks, and I hate to be a stickler here, but for me this is kind of important. It's not free agency, but they do give us our agency. Everything is in its agency, is free to act, okay? That doesn't mean it's free. There was a price for that agency that was paid.
Well, and, I use the word free
exactly.
in the sense
we all
of
do.
Freedom, in the sense of
yes,
freedom.
Yes, we're
not
all
that
free
it was,
to do that, yeah.
Not that it was free,
mm-hmm.
but
you bet.
If you prefer, I will just use the term agency and try to be more correct. So,
well, that's just a recent interpretation that's come out.
Well, thank you for the correction. So the gist of the idea here is that even the federal government and others have agency to make their own decisions, and there was legislation that was first enacted about 10 years after polygamy was official here in the territories at the time in Utah. And what happened was, and this is fascinating, on July 8th of 1862, Abraham Lincoln signs into law the first anti-polygamy legislation. We tend to really like Lincoln, but he was the first guy who
well, he ran on a platform. The Republican platform was to end the twin barbarisms of slavery and polygamy.
Yes, and there are those in the church who still think that they are both twin barbarisms, but I'll leave that discussion for a different day. The point is, what happened here? And was this something that God sanctioned? Or, as some fundamentalist groups would claim, is this something that is against God's will and the church just buckled? And the answer is that if you look really closely at this, it's very clear that this was done by revelation. And that's the main point that I personally wanted to make here. There was a statement that was made on September 24th of 1890. President Wilford Woodruff met with the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and his counselors. And the next day, President Wilford Woodruff made this official statement, quote, "I have arrived at a point in the history of my life as president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints where I am under the necessity of acting for the temporal salvation of the church." And then he goes on and talks about what the United States government has done, close quote. And so people look at that and say, well, this wasn't by revelation. He's just doing this to save the physical, the temporal salvation of the church so the church won't disappear. But they also overlook many other statements that he made. Quote, "I have had some revelations of late, and very important ones to me, and I will tell you what the Lord has said to me. The Lord has told me by revelation that there are many members of the church throughout Zion who are sorely tried in their hearts because of this manifesto." And then he goes on and talks about how this is done by revelation. This is something that God was behind because the most important thing is for the church to continue on in its existence. So that's part of the background. It was by revelation, not just as a necessity.
Well, and like the second declaration, which we know a little more about how it was put together and who was involved, President Woodruff did meet with several of the apostles, and it was harder for them to meet in those days because many of them were on what they called the underground. They were federal fugitives. My own great-great-grandfather spent some time in prison with George Q. Cannon because he was polygamist. They were kind of martyrs to the cause there. And I can't remember how long President Cannon spent, but maybe it was 6 months, something like that. I can't remember what it was. But it was a real challenge for them. And Elder Mariner W. Merrill, who was over the Logan Temple, and Moses Thatcher, who later was disciplined because of some of the things he said about plural marriage after the manifesto and then after what they call the second manifesto. So, the history of plural marriage in the church started really rocky, let's say, and came out into the light of day, and then it was put out, and then it ended really rocky. So even after the manifesto, there was still some that were continuing to practice it, and some that may have even been authorized until 1906, when the public attacks on the church were a problem. They were trying to seat Reed Smoot in the Senate, and there were hearings. It was a full-blown trial. President Joseph F. Smith was put under oath and questioned about these type of things. And, the church eventually accommodated that, and they call it an accommodation. But I don't view that, and never have, as just being something that's, oh, yeah, they just did it because it was an accommodation. I mean, President Woodruff said, if the Lord had asked me to, we would have fought to the bitter end. We'd have gone out in the wilderness again. And, you have to look at the history of the early church. They would have done it. I mean, they had no compunction about going to Mexico or going to Central America or going anywhere where the Lord told them to go and leaving everything behind. They'd left Kirtland behind. They'd left Missouri behind. They'd left Nauvoo behind in spite of its wealth. I mean, Nauvoo at the time was bigger than Chicago.
Yes.
And they left it behind. They just abandoned everything. So obviously the hand of the Lord is in this manifesto in particular. And so, there's a lot of scholarship about it. In fact, there was a recent book this past year about the Reed Smoot hearings in particular. And I remember way back, one of the things that might have been on my list that we talked about in the first hour was Mike Quinn's dialogue article.
Yes.
About the post-manifesto polygamy, which, sometimes you question his sources, but sometimes they do connect the dots.
Right. Quinn, at least.
The late Michael Quinn, I should say.
Late,
he passed
Michael
away this
Quinn,
year.
Yes, passed away recently. I was always a great admirer of the fact that he could find an incredible amount of sources. You might get a little bit like I do with Bart Ehrman, whose name came up last hour, to the end and go, what? How did you come up to this conclusion with your sources?
But, well, there's one of his books that I never could get through.
Yeah, but I can probably guess which one. But he was great in terms of finding sources. He was terrific.
Oh, yeah.
And I quite like that dialogue article that you referenced.
I just believe that he was at his best when he had a strong editor. His BYU Studies articles were pretty good. His first edition of the J. Reuben Clark biography was really good. And that's when he had an editor who really, kind of kept him on task, didn't let him get overrun by his footnotes and by his sources. And then, when he published with others who were, let's just say, more loose editors, it kind of got away from him at times.
Yeah. Well, he was also really good when his major centerpiece source, meaning the Salamander letter, turning out to be a fake, didn't dissuade him from changing his conclusions. Those kinds of things were a problem. But in other words, I loved his scholarship, but he did kind of begin with the end in mind in terms
of
his conditions.
But eventually they did have to do what they call the second manifesto that's not as highly publicized, and it's certainly not canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants.
Right.
And that pretty much put paid to the issue, and then even apostles who kind of went against that were disciplined or removed from the quorum.
Right.
I think the last one was in 1943, if I understand it right.
Here's another Woodruff quote that I really like on this subject. Quote, I saw exactly in vision what would come to pass if something was not done. And I have had the Spirit upon me for a long time, but what I wanted to say is that I should have let all the temples go out of our hands. I should have gone to prison myself. I should have let every other man go there, had not the Lord God in heaven commanded me to do what I did do, close quote, which is the point you were making earlier. That's exactly your point. God told him to do this, and if he had told them to go the other direction, they would have been all in forever.
You know, and I've read about Wilford. His diaries are available. They're now available online. I think the Historian's Office is making them available, but if not, there's an edition. Signature did an edition, and I think there's a new update of that. But Thomas Alexander wrote a book, Waiting for World's End.
Yes.
That was really good. Now, it was a bit dry. As a book critic, I'll just say it was a tough read for me.
It's one of my favorite books.
Well, good. There we go. Shows that, you know, you maybe have better taste than I do. But I will tell you this, though, that Laurel Thatcher did her book about a house full of females recently that used extensive quotes from Wilford's diary as well as his wife. And when I read about him, I fall in love with him. I am so full of admiration. Now, he could be stern. He was a pretty black and white individual, but he left everything on the table. Nothing. So when he says, I'd have gone to jail, I would have done all of these things that you just quoted, Martin, he would have done it. There is no doubt in my mind he was a very dedicated follower of the Lord. And, you know, one of the things that I love that they have at the Church History Library is the recording. You can probably even get it online now. I haven't tried, where he bears his testimony of Joseph Smith, because he was one of our last prophets who actually saw and dealt with Joseph Smith. I mean, he was one of the 12 apostles, clear back.
Yeah.
So it's just an amazing bridge between the time of Joseph and the modern era. And really, I think you could argue that this first manifesto, the first declaration, enters a new phase of church history where the church is more in tune with the world and is ready to expand, rather than just be this isolated group out in the deserts of the West. And yeah, they had had missionary efforts, and yes, they had grown, but the growth for the future was still to come. And so these things were necessary, these trials, these changes, these revelations, I think were necessary in order to provide a foundation upon which the church could build going forward. And I think it's important for us to look at them like that.
It's interesting. People say, people say the church has abandoned polygamy. I've heard that from critics, and I've heard that from people in the church. Some are happy about it, some not so much. One of the interesting things is, in some ways, the church has not done that. If you have a spouse that dies, you can be sealed to someone else for the eternities. And if a woman is married in succession to several different men, and then eventually they all pass away, someone else can do their temple work, and they can all be sealed to the woman. So how these things are all sorted out in the next life, we don't know, but in a limited sense, particularly in temple work, that the issue of plural sealings, I won't call them plural marriages, but plural sealings are still in existence. Anything else you'd like to cover here for official declaration?
No, I would just encourage the listeners to go to some of the supplementary material, which I always do. The Revelations in Context, which is in the church history section of your Gospel Library app on your phone, talks about this. Jed Woodworth writes a really good article about it called The Messenger and the Manifesto. And it shows a few of the more human reactions. I on a smaller scale, I remember as a boy going, we used to go to the priesthood session. So I think I was a deacon or a teacher in 1975. Now that I think about it, I was a teacher. And I remember going to the conference session. We would go to the tabernacle and go to the priesthood session. I was with my grandfather Ellis. He'd been a mission president. He'd been a bishop a couple times, and he was with us. And I remember it was at that session that President Kimball announced they were going to do away with the office of 70s in the stake. Well, I remember sitting next to my grandfather and having him shake his head and mutter under his breath, they can't do that. It's in the Doctrine and Covenants. And then he never said another word about it. And it was like, they can't. But you know what? We're a church of modern revelation. We have living prophets and apostles who are prophets, seers, and revelators. Yes, they can. And they
yes,
did.
Yes, they can. And
yes,
they,
they can. And that's what we forget here. So when we want to say, hey, this is an accommodation, look, we have living prophets and apostles. You know, I was thinking about this as I was coming to the studio tonight, and I remember on a much smaller scale, President Nelson, when he closed the temples because of the pandemic, I could see him having the same feelings about that as Wilford Woodruff. That, Lord, this work is vital. This work is important. This is a commandment. You know, we'll close them, but if you want me to keep them open, we'll keep them open. But, you know, that kind of a thing. And I think that's the feeling I get when I hear President Nelson talk about closing the temples. And I can only imagine how gut-wrenchingly painful that would have been for him, as well as the other members of the presidency and the 12, to make that determination, considering how vital that mission is, not just to those who passed, but the blessings of the temple that go forward, especially after all of the resources that have been put in to make temples available to, you know, most church members around the world. So, yeah, it still happens even today. This is a lesson. We are a church guided by modern revelation.
Yeah. Great. So, great comments. Official declaration, too. This is the one that where all worthy males, where the blacks get the priesthood. And I thought about how could I...
Where were you when you heard about the revelation?
Oh, I can tell you exactly.
That's what I want you to do. Yeah,
exactly.
I think anybody who was alive at that time can tell you where they were.
Yes.
Where were you?
This was a huge deal. I was actually in church, and I heard it from the bishop announce it from the pulpit. I had not heard it before then, but that was a really, really big deal. It was huge.
So I was at Liberty Jail.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I've talked about this on the air a couple of times with John and Kevin, but I, as a graduating senior, this is 1978, our school seminary had put together a tour of church history sites. Mm-hmm. So we'd take buses, we rented chartered buses, stayed in KOAs and tents, boys over here, girls over there, you know, everything on the up and up, parents, chaperones. Great trip. I think it lasted about two and a half weeks. So we're on our way home. We're at the Liberty Jail. We see the little diorama that they have there, which is very similar to what they have today, even though, you know, this is 1978. Not a lot's changed at the Liberty Jail, I can tell you that, because we were stationed in the military there about 30 years ago. It was the same then. So we're there, and then after they present this, how here's where Joseph received this revelation, here's where he received this revelation, our seminary teacher asked the guide to tell us what had happened in Salt Lake. And they had just announced the revelation in Salt Lake. And I will tell you, it is one of the strongest experiences spiritually that I've ever had in my life. Even talking about it right now sends something through me, because it was a reaffirmation for me of, you know, modern revelation, that we have a living prophet. And I'd met President Kimball a couple of times by then, I think twice. So, well, obviously we never communicated, but he shook my hand. I was in his presence a couple of times, and it was a very powerful witness that we did have living prophets. And then my second thought right after that was, holy cow, we better get going, because, you know, the last days are here. Something that just continues to manifest itself. But I think every one of us who was alive at that time remembers, and with very few exceptions, I don't know anybody that really was unhappy about that. Of course, those few that were obviously disassociated.
Yeah,
and I never would have.
I could mention a few, but I won't.
Well, there was a big article. I remember an ad taken out in the Salt Lake Tribune. I remember, but you know. Once again, that was an amazing experience, and that's where there's a couple of references that provide the context to this that I think are so important. There's books, there's articles. I mean, you've got Armand Maus, you've got Lester Bush on one side, but Edward Kimball, President Kimball's son,
right,
did a few chapters on it in his second biography of his dad. And then there's two versions of that. So there's the one that's published by Deseret Book, and then there's a much longer unedited version of a manuscript that was cut almost in half, partly because of size considerations, but I think quite a bit of it was some of the reference material and some other things. It was just very frank and honest about who said what, and all the way through the presidency of President Kimball, and I think it was just a little, more revealing, I think, maybe than Deseret Book wanted to do. So they put it on they compromised and they put it on a CD that they sold in the back of the book, and yet so that it would be more publicly available, that version from the CD was published in BYU Studies. It's issue 47. I can't remember which one it is, but you can go online and get it. And it's about 75 pages, and it talks about the background. It talks about various statements made by the first presidency, various approaches they took, various corrections they made over the years. And then it talks about President Kimball's actions leading up to that in great detail. And then after that, it talks about what we do know about that marvelous experience, and there's no other word to describe it.
Yeah.
Leonard Arrington was tasked as the church historian to take statements from the brethren about that, and he provides a whole chapter on that in his autobiography that's very revealing, and then in the biography that Greg Prince wrote about him, it also gives us some more details about that. Just some phenomenal things that were, you know, publicly stated by the brethren. And all those present are gone. But I remember President Hinckley said this about it afterwards. He said, sorry, I got to call it up here. He said, there was a hallowed and sanctified atmosphere in the room. For me, it felt as if a conduit opened between the heavenly throne and the kneeling, pleading prophet of God who was joined by his brethren. Every man in that circle, by the power of the Holy Ghost, knew the same thing. It was a quiet and sublime occasion. There was not the sound as of a rushing mighty wind, There were not even cloven tongues like as a fire as there had been on the day of Pentecost, but there was a Pentecostal spirit, for the Holy Ghost was there. We left that meeting subdued and reverent and joyful. Not one of us who was present on that occasion was ever quite the same after that. Nor has the church been quite the same. There was perfect unity among us in our experience and in our understanding. I can't think of any better description than that. Each of the brethren, by the way, did have a different experience, and some of them had much, what you would call a much more clear vision into the next life.
Yes, I one of my good friends, Dan McConkie, is a grandson of of Bruce R. McConkie, and he's told me several times, although I haven't talked to him for quite a few years now, some of the details about what you're referring to, and some people actually heard what they would describe as a voice from God. Some described other manifestations, and so this was something that was very, very real, and more than just, we feel good about this, and gee, let's move forward and see what happens. I mean, this was the real deal.
Well, this is what Arrington says about it. He said, Kimball opened their meeting by saying he felt impressed to pray to the Lord and ask their permission to be mouth. He went to the altar. Those in attendance said that as he began his earnest prayers, and they're surrounding the altar. There's the ordinance that they do as brethren. And he says this, those in attendance said that as he began his earnest prayer, they suddenly realized it was not Kimball's prayer, but the Lord was speaking through him. Now, this is exactly the type of phenomenon that's described in 3 Nephi. If you recall, the disciples were praying, you know, to the Lord, to Heavenly Father, and then all of a sudden they switched by revelation and were praying directly to Jesus. So this is something similar. A revelation was being declared. Kimball himself realized the words were not his but the Lord's. During that prayer, some of the 12, at least two who have said so publicly, were transported into a celestial atmosphere, saw a divine presence, and the figures of former presidents of the church, portraits of whom were hanging on the walls around them, smiling to indicate their approval and sanction. Others acknowledged the voice of the Lord coming, as with the prophet Elijah, through the still small voice. The voice of the Spirit followed their earnest search for wisdom and understanding. So, two of the apostles present described the experience as a day of Pentecost, similar to the one in the Kirtland Temple on April 6, 1836. The day of its dedication, they saw a heavenly personage, heard heavenly music. To the temple-clothed members, the gathering, incredible and without compare, was the greatest singular event of their lives. Those I talked with wept as they spoke of it. All were certain they had witnessed a revelation from God. I mean,
That's neat.
You know, and he was asked to do that in his official capacity. That's the kind of thing that I wish more of us would see. Now, there's those, and I've heard people, you know, complain, well, why don't we have a Thus Saith the Lord? Well, I think in part because the secretaries had been excused. I mean, all of the reports indicate that they did their regular meeting. They were all fasting. Normally, they go there in a state of fasting for their regular meeting. They do their business, and then they have a luncheon. And this time, President Kimball said, I'm going to ask you to continue to fast. And he excused everyone from the room but the 12. And two of them, one was in the hospital, and one was in South America. So they had to get them on the phone later. I think Marky Peterson was in South America, and Stapley was in the hospital. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that just, once again, reinforce the issue that we talked about earlier.
Right. I wanted to take just a minute and mention some of the background for this, because some people say, and I don't want to overlook this, but wait a minute, we had during Joseph Smith's lifetime, black elders who were part of the church, Warner McCrary, Walker Lewis, Joseph T. Ball, Elijah Abel, Peter Kerr, and others. And you also have 2 Nephi chapter 26, verse 33, that says, all are alike unto God, black and white, bond and free, so on and so forth. So how is it that you could have something like this that needs a revelation to happen? And the answer to that is that when the saints, well, I mean, this is my answer to that. You know, there are probably dozens of ways that this could be responded to. But when many people came into the church, they came from the Protestant background, and it was not some LDS point of view. It was a Protestant point of view that there was a curse of Cain and that it meant the blacks. And that's why there were black Baptist churches and black Presbyterian churches and black other churches and so on and so forth. And even in Catholic congregations, blacks were not treated the same as everyone else. And in that regard, to a very great degree, during the Joseph Smith era, blacks were treated almost exactly the same as everyone else in the church. And when the church got to Missouri, that was a problem because you just had the slave uprisings and the people of Missouri were already worried. People say, well, why did the church get kicked out of Missouri? And most people think, oh, it was religious differences. They didn't like our doctrine. No, biggest single reason was the slave issue. And there was even an article that was published in one of the local newspapers that said the Latter-day Saints are trying to foment a slave uprising here. And how do we know that? Well, because the black members of their congregation are walking around like everyone else and acting like ordinary people, and that's going to give our slaves ideas, and we can't put up with that. And so in response to that, W.W. Phelps published a responsive editorial in the local paper, but it was not well received. And it was over that issue and several others that led to things like Hans Mill and other huge tragedies. And when Brigham Young saw all of that, and he had others who had come into the church with the curse of Cain idea that they believed in the late 1840s or 52, depending on which statement and when you want to tack it down, he changed without revelation the church's prior conduct, and 2 Nephi 26:33 was literally disregarded. There's just no other way to say it, because from that point on, blacks were not treated the same as whites. And so if you search back for some kind of a revelation that would say,
no, all the history says there's not such a revelation.
That's right.
It may have been an administrative policy that was so entrenched
and
that it required a revelation.
That's right. And that's where I was going. And that's exactly right. And one of the things that I like so much moving forward here is that when President Kimball got to this, he didn't just say, let's all pray about it. He actually asked several of the apostles, come and do some research, and I want you to get back to me and tell me if this is possible. And he thought about it and did his due diligence.
Well, they argued about it for months, and gradually the church had been moving in that direction. They first of all opened the priesthood to members from Fiji. They took the burden off of members to show their lineage, especially in Brazil.
Yes, Brazil was a big one.
Brazil was a big one. There were a couple of others. When they had the temple in Brazil, that kind of instigated it. But yeah, and in fact, Arrington reports that you know, there was a period of emphasis, and the brethren were asked to, oh, here it is, and it was Joseph Fielding McConkie who said this to the ensign. He said, the first presidency had been interested in the topic for years, President Kimball especially, and had felt a message coming through. Last June, several of the apostles, so this is about a year, which is pretty quick for them.
Yes.
I mean, on the issue of combining the priesthood quorums, I saw some minutes of a discussion that took place in the 80s. And there was one apostle on one side of combining them, one apostle keeping them separate, and they were quoting from John Taylor when they had the same discussion in the 1880s, 100 years before.
Interesting.
So, you know, some of these just, we don't comprehend the burdens that the brethren deal with in that way, but they said that a year before, several of the apostles were invited to submit memos on various implications of the question, historical, medical, sociological, doctrinal, etc. Among them, elders Packer, Monson, and McConkie. And the first presidency had made it a matter of prayer a number of times in the temple and had received no answer. So they, you know, they all went to that meeting, but you're right, and it was Elder McConkie who said that his family was asking them. His family, McConkie's family, asked him several questions for clarification of the Pentecostal experience, and each time he gave the same answer. The rushing of the great wind, just like Kirtland. Angelic choirs, just like Kirtland. Cloven tongues of fire, just like Kirtland. Visitors from across the veil, just like Kirtland. You know, but he didn't identify who that was or anything else, and so some of the other brethren have said similar things. And like Kirtland, not everybody saw everything.
Right.
I mean, I think that's also important. I mean, it's kind of like...
I don't think everybody saw everything at the original day of Pentecost in the New Testament.
Well, you know, there's always been what I call the prophetic vision, or the prophetic calling. I think Blake Osler wrote about this, the theophany of the prophetic calling or something, and I can't remember if it was a BYU Studies article or a dialogue article, but, you know, when you look at it, when you call a prophet, take a look at what happens. You have a vision of the entire world. Okay, what are our examples in the scripture? Well, we have Moses, Book of Moses, chapter 1. We have Lehi. We have Nephi. We have Ezekiel. We have Isaiah. We have Jeremiah. We have Joseph Smith with the 3 degrees of glory. We have Enoch in the book of pseudepigraphal book of First Enoch. We have these prophets who see certain things, and they reveal different elements of it. Notice, in Nephi's vision, all of a sudden it stops. He says, okay, the rest of this, you can see it, but John is going to talk about it in the Bible. You know, he's going to talk about the last days. So they each see a different part of it, and I think the brethren were in the same boat. Some of them saw something, some of them heard something, some of them felt, they all felt something. But at the end of the day, every one of them had the witness. And it gets back to what I quoted from President Hinckley earlier. None of them were ever the same. And the church was never the same.
Yeah.
Hasn't been the same since. And it's it continues to grow.
Yeah. Bruce R. McConkie for once said, forget all the stuff I used to say.
Yeah.
Don't forget it. Well, we spoke with limited knowledge. We spoke with limited understanding.
And it looks like he was one of those who was promoting it the most.
Yes.
From a scriptural standpoint.
Yeah.
He reviewed the scriptures, and in particular, he used the third article of faith. In his biography done by his son Joseph, he you know, kind of summarizes a little bit of that communication, where he said one of the things that Elder McConkie gave to the first presidency was the article, we believe that through the atonement of Christ, all mankind might be saved.
All mankind. Which all is
mankind.
A great segue into the articles.
Well, that's where I was going.
Yeah.
You know, all mankind may be saved by obedience to the, you know, principles and ordinances of the gospel.
Yeah. Yeah. Articles of faith. We've got about 10 minutes here, and great segue, by the way. The wonderful thing, well, a couple of comments by way of background of the Articles of Faith. This, of course, is is an excerpt from the Wentworth letter. This is a letter that Joseph Smith wrote to a newspaper editor on condition that it would be faithfully presented in the paper and that it wouldn't be excerpted and hatchet job done. And part of what was in this letter to Mr. Wentworth, we now have as the Articles of Faith. And many people think, well, these are the first, last, and only Articles of Faith. Well, that's not true. For a long time before Joseph Smith's were sort of the standard doctrinal version, which took decades and decades, I once spent a couple of years and tracked down as many different versions of Articles of Faith as I could. And I found some that had as many as 16 articles, and they had things in them about temple, which, of course, we don't find in the 13, and other subjects about the resurrection, which we don't find there. So the Articles of Faith are not somehow a comprehensive overview of the beliefs of the church, but they are so elegant on the subjects upon which they touch. They aren't yes Trinitarian, no Trinitarian, fine nuances. It's very simple. We believe in God, the Eternal Father, and His Son, and in the Holy Ghost. His Son, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost. That's such a simple, wonderful statement. Everybody in Christianity can believe that, and nobody's going to take offense at that, and nobody's going to quibble with that. It's so wonderful how Joseph Smith put these together, and every time I look at the wording and the way it was presented, apparently with great thought to a general audience, I just marvel. They're fabulous. They're wonderful. And there have been tweaks to them. You know, we don't say that Zion's going to be upon this, the American continent, anymore, you know, because we're a worldwide church. There have been a few minor little changes, but they are just so elegant and wonderful.
Well, the Wentworth letter, Wentworth never published it. I mean, the first time it really was published, it was published by the Times and Seasons. And then later it was more officially published by Franklin D. Richards with the pamphlets that later became the Pearl of Great Price in the 1850s over in England. And then it was canonized in 1880. And it's officially in the Pearl of Great Price,
in
not
1880,
the Darkening
Yeah, Codes. And 1880 is quite a few decades after it
yeah,
was originally
yeah.
written.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, that was another thing. As a young man, I remember, gosh, here we are. We're going to take these two. We have the vision of the Celestial Kingdom, and then we have Joseph F. Smith's vision of the dead. And we canonized them, and we put them in the Pearl of Great Price. And then in 1981, just a few years later, oh, just kidding, Section 138, 137. You know? I mean, okay. Yeah. And at that time, I remember as a young man going, gosh, this is great. We're going to get new revelations all the time. We got the Declaration on the Priesthood. We got these two new revelations. It's so cool. And then, you know, when they readed the Scriptures, they talked about adding some other things. They talked about adding the lectures on faith back into the Doctrine and Covenants. They talked about adding the Joseph Smith translation, just accepting it. Because for a long time, because the manuscripts were held by the Community of Christ, then the Reorganized Church, there was just some doubt as to how verifiable those manuscripts were. But as it turns out, they're pretty authentic. And then they were going to add this King's Follett sermon. And then they were going to add what they called the Sermon at the Grove. Those were the four. And each one of them had a different set of challenges, if you will. Different set of challenges. So the lectures on faith, you know, they're a little hard to explain because they don't get into the full doctrines that we've got. And that's why they were partly taken out in the first place. The Joseph Smith translation, well, okay, we believe the Bible as far as it's translated correctly. And then all of a sudden, oh, you got your own Bible. So
yeah.
There's, you know,
and
some arguments about
faith.
That.
How many in
well,
the Godhead?
And
two?
The other thing is scholarship. Scholarship is showing that, you know, the Joseph Smith translation had some other influences at least. So, you know, there's you know, Thomas Wayman's done some work on that and some others. And so it's like, you know, maybe the brethren, when they left that out, probably knew what they were doing. Although, actually, the vote was almost unanimous.
Well, I've always liked, and, you know, we shouldn't get too sidetracked. I always get sidetracked. No, you're cool on the Joseph Smith translation, but that was not a finished project, and it was not.
No.
It could easily have been canonized during Joseph Smith's lifetime, and it wasn't. I think there's a reason for that. But I've done a little bit of reading of diaries between Joseph Smith's era and when the Articles of Faith originally put in there. And it wasn't so much that something was left out or that there was some problem with the doctrine that was in there. It was this minor little detail about how creeds aren't such a great deal in the church.
Yeah.
And yet, here we are with our...
The Mormon Catechism.
Articles of Faith that
the Mormon Catechism
looks an awful lot like a creed. And so there's this great pushback on the idea of having something that you got to believe. And the truth is, and I've actually asked a few bishops this. I've said, if somebody came in and wanted to be baptized, and they said, yeah, I believe Joseph Smith's a prophet, and yeah, I believe that the gospel's been restored, but, you know, this ninth article, I'm not so sure about, would you let them get baptized anyway? And every one of them have sat and thought about it and said, yeah, of course I would. And I think that these are articles of faith in which the church believes, but we are still free to believe what we will. And if we have a basic belief in there, I mean... Don't get me wrong. I love all the articles of faith. I think they're great.
But yeah, I was about ready to cut off your mic here.
There you go. Yeah, it was, for all who are listening, he was reaching over ready to strangle me and pull that mic off.
No, I wouldn't strangle you. Yeah, just push the button.
Push the button. This is a set of beliefs, and in our church, we are free as long as we believe in the basic precepts of the restoration. We don't have to believe absolutely every single thing, because line upon line, precept upon precept, we'll get there. And this is not a creed in the traditional sense, which is why I think they originally adopted as articles of faith. Faith is something that you believe in, not that is mandatory. This is not the law of the church.
It's more explanatory.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, the whole purpose of it with the Wentworth letter. Now, there's some question about who may have written it. Sidney Rigdon or Oliver Cowdery would have had some influence, but overall, obviously, it was something that Joseph sent.
It was. Oliver Cowdery had his own set of articles, and there were
was
only...
Was it Larry Morris that wrote about that? I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't recall either, but there were 8 articles in it, and it's a little bit different, and they were okay, but I like Joseph's better.
Well,
they're a little more simple.
These are foundational. They're great, and it's good that we memorize them usually when we're primary kids. And they still stick with us. In fact, as I was thinking about it and getting ready for this, I thought, you know what? You should remember them again. You should kind of revisit these to get them back in your head again. Elder McConkie had a great book, his last book, A New Witness for the Articles of Faith. And Elder Talmadge wrote the Articles of Faith that was based on these. Both of those are real good, especially with Elder McConkie's sense of doctrine. And placing it in a doctrinal context that fits in with the frameworks of other beliefs and other principles. So that's, you know, that's another one that I'd recommend to people.
Very cool. We have about a minute left. Let's invite everybody to listen to Interpreter Radio every Sunday, 7 to 9 p.m. We have a number of different hosts. Go to the Interpreter Foundation's website. Any other final comments that you have for people?
Well, tonight? I just, once again, it's a great pleasure to be on the air, and I hope that those that are listening will take to heart some of the things that we've talked about, some of the references. Do some checking. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And you'll find that it really does verify that we do have living prophets today, and the Interpreter Foundation supports that and promotes it.
That we do. And you know what? There was that prophetic end right as the music starts. Join us again next week.
That's right.
The Interpreter Radio Show.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Terry.